You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting, important things.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and the other person on the screen is Dr. Wylan Wilson. Why don't you give a mini bio of who you are, what you do, and how'd we get here? How'd you get to where you are?
All right. It sounds good. So, yes, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
It is wonderful to be here. Such a joy to be in conversation with you. So, yes, I am Wylan Wilson, and I am right now associate professor of theological ethics here at Duke Divinity School. And my research is at the intersection of bioethics, gender, and theology. And how did I get here? That's a big question, right?
Well, maybe that part of the question of how you got here from your... Well, I mean, you could just walk through where you were in school, but that's not quite how you got here.
Yeah, right? I know what
you're saying. It's a much bigger question. So,
we
are here primarily because, I mean, how you made it to me and how I made it to you was that you'd written this book, Womanist Bioethics, Social Justice, Spirituality, and Black Women's Health. So, what does that mean? What is womanist bioethics, and what other kinds of bioethics would there be?
That is the question right there. Excellent. So womanist bioethics is actually a way of responding to the Black women's health crisis in a way that centers the everyday experience and spirituality of women of color seeking justice in health, in science, religion, and the environment. And we can start with, say, bioethics in general, right? Because bioethics is why we have a womanist bioethics.
Yes, right.
So what bioethics is, it's the study of ethical questions and dilemmas that arise in health, science, and technology, right? And the reason why we have womanist bioethics is because mainstream bioethics, what it has done is it has left out important voices, experiences, and perspectives of minoritized populations in the U.S. So not just of women, but of African-American, of immigrants, of Asian Americans, Hispanic populations. Mainstream bioethics has been done from a very European American kind of center, right?
And okay, so let's back up even a little further. Who would come knocking on the door of a bioethicist? That was a mouthful.
Yeah. So,
would somebody seek out the perspective of somebody whose field was ethics, bioethics?
Yeah. So to answer that question, what I'll do, I want to start let's start historically, right?
Great,
I think that would be really helpful. So, my broader field that I'm trained in is, you know, like I said earlier, theological ethics, right? Or Christian ethics.
Yeah.
So if you look at particularly the field of Christian ethics, These are folks who are theologians. So some of them are pastors. Many of the ones who, particularly who were important in establishing the field of bioethics, were theological ethicists. They were Christian ethicists. So these were folks who were pastors and theologians, and they were looking at these issues that these folks normally deal with, right? Beginning of life issues, end of life issues, issues of suffering, right? And so there is this consensus in the field of bioethics, particularly if you look at it historically, that the medicine really and truly, it saved, you know, it saved theological ethics, right? Because theology, as you know, is it's philosophical, you know, it's not, it's sometimes it can be so, it's something that we do here in the academy and not really grounded. But when theologians started really tackling these problems of beginning of life, end of life, suffering, and you know what was happening in the medical field, the technological innovations that were really changing the face of medicine, right? Even the changes in medicine from, you remember the lone doctor who would go and do house visits, sure, to now the hospitals that we have, right? These bastions of ethics and bioethics. So all of those changes were really significant in the establishment of the field of bioethics, because, you know, the bioethicists now are very much embedded in hospital settings, right? Because it's dealing with these issues of, you know, technological, biomedical, technological innovations, suffering and end of life and beginning of life and all that. So that's kind of a long answer.
I appreciate that. I think that would be helpful for people. So bioethicists might have something to say if, hey, you know, a viable heart has surfaced because somebody who is dying, and is a donor, an organ donor, has this organ available. There's a bunch of people waiting for it. Who gets it?
There you go. Yes.
So they would have something to say about that, right?
Oh, without
there'd be medical questions, there'd be ethical questions there. Got it. So, and at some point, I want to ask you to, you know, if there's a way of demonstrating a difference between, I don't remember what you called it, conventional or traditional ethics, bioethics, and womanist bioethics, but so that we can see how that is a different, how we're looking through different lenses there.
Yes, definitely.
So the reason there's a need for womanist bioethics is because the perspectives of the considerations of ethics have left out the perspectives of women, and especially women of color. Or am I putting words in your mouth? Or
no, you're doing great. Look at you.
So that's not a, yeah. So how'd they get it wrong?
Well, here's the thing. Yeah.
They want to get it right.
No, I hear you. And that is really, really important. And, you know, I like to say, what's important about womanist bioethics, is that the reason why I created this this method of doing bioethics, right, is because we needed to expand the narrative, right? Because a lot of times what happens, I always talk about, especially in my classes, I talk about how important narratives are. Because if you think about it, why is it that you have a certain kind of perception of yourself, an understanding of yourself in relationship to others, in relationship to the environment, in relationship, to the divine mystery, right? And that usually that comes through narratives, whether they're family narratives, whether they're your faith narratives you get from, kind of a,
sure,
a faith tradition or whatever. And one of the things that is really clear as we look at fields like, bioethics, is that the narratives, the meta narratives that kind of really formed the field and formed the scholars, who are perpetuating the knowledge in that field, those narratives they're incomplete, right? They're not expansive. They're not including these really important experiences and voices and perspectives of people particularly from minoritized populations. And so what I look at, and it's interesting the way the academy has developed, right? The academy in the United States, even in Europe, as it developed, persons who were running the academy, persons who were determining what counted as what was valid, right? Valid knowledge, what should form us and shape us in terms of these meta narratives. Historically, they've been European and European American men, right? And so because of that, that has been the focus, and those are the perspectives that have absolutely shaped us and shaped, our relationship to one another. So as I was out in, I was in Tuskegee, Alabama, at the National Center for Bioethics and Research and Healthcare there, that was one of the first places I began working after getting my degree, right? And so I'm out there and I'm in the heart of the Alabama Black Belt. And the bioethics center, so most people, when they think of bioethics centers, they're thinking, oh, wow, they're looking at these really interesting technological innovations, like you were saying, looking at organ donation. There are all kinds of really interesting things and exciting things going on in the field of bioethics. But that's not how I came to bioethics. When you come to bioethics through the rural Southern Alabama Black Belt, the same place where there were enslaved populations, right, in this nation, you're going to be dealing with, and I was actually dealing with, issues of health disparities, right, racial inequalities, and discrimination, kind of in this sediment of historical inequalities and discrimination. So I came to bioethics in the, I would say, it was a way that was very much really grounded in the experience of minoritized populations.
Do you mean discrimination in medicine, in medical fields, in healthcare? Is that what you're referring to, or you mean historical discrimination?
Both. It's really both. One of the things that was really important, and really powerful in my research for writing this book, is looking at our, what we call our Jim Crow healthcare history, right? So we talk about, a lot of times we talk about our history of, segregation in the United States in terms of, restaurants, education, right? Brown versus Board of Education. Those are, these are really well-known kinds of issues when we talk about segregation, right? But we very rarely talk about and hear about segregation in healthcare. So hospitals did not desegregate until about 1964, right? And so that meant what you have then is you have, and I even include some of these stories in the book, but that meant you have stories about African Americans and even poor whites who were locked out of a healthcare system, right? That was discriminatory. It was racially discriminatory, economically discriminatory. And so these are folk who experienced the healthcare system feeling unheard, feeling unseen and uncared for, because even though our healthcare institutions prioritized cure, they were lacking in care because of this convergence of race and health, which really was a deadly combination.
Just to bring it down to, you know, sort of grounded in experience. So here's a question. Like, so two people come into either the same place or different places with the same complaints. One is sent to radiology to get an MRI, and the other, well, there is no MRI machine available there. Yes. Is that what you mean by discrimination?
Here's what I'll say. So I'll give you so one of the stories I have in the book is one of my own grandmother, who when she was pregnant with my mother and ready to give birth, and she almost died giving birth to my mother, the nearest hospital, and this was in northern Florida, and the nearest hospital, which was really close to where she could have been taken, right? It did not accept Black patients.
Black people.
Yeah. And so she had to, granddad had to, they had to make sure that they, you know, drove. It was really a rough ride. But there are so many other stories. There was the dean of Fisk University back in, this was in 1931. She had gotten in a car accident. She and a student, they were traveling in a car and they got in a car accident, and the closest hospital, of course, did not take Black patients. And so she had to ride to a hospital, you know, 50 miles away. But of course, by that time, because she had severe head injuries, she died. And so there are all these stories, even of my own grandfather, who had to literally sit outside of a, that there was a clinic that did serve Black folks. And this was, again, in Florida. But unfortunately, they served them only after all of the white patients were served. So he literally, and he had to sit outside on the ground. He's in pain, you know, waiting to be seen by a doctor. And as soon as what he thought was the last white person to come through the doors, here comes another person. So, you know, like that kind of, you know, that kind of suffering, right? And so now, What's interesting about it, and there was an article by Van Newkirk, and he wrote this article asking, you know, how far have we come from our Jim Crow healthcare history, particularly when we look at the statistics regarding Black women and maternal health, right? Black maternal health, because Black women are 2 to 4 times more likely than white women to die from pregnancy-related complications, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we look at the kinds of disparities that still exist, it's very clear that we're still stuck, and we're still dealing with the issue of race and health colliding in very deadly ways, even in the 21st century, which is...
Well, so let me... It's not pushing back, but let me ask some questions about. So, what you described, you know, people not being accepted at a hospital, so you have to drive 50 miles away, or people having to wait till all the white folks are dealt with, and That's just flat out full of my, I mean, my world, that the way that lands in my brain that has not studied this is that's just full on racism, right? That's like, wait a second, you know, like, hold on, that we know what that looks like, right? You can't sit at this lunch counter. You can't drink out of that water fountain. You can't go to that school. That is just full on. But what I'm trying to get out is, okay, so what's the womanist piece? That's the racist piece. What's the difference between the unethical discrimination of between human beings because of something that does not matter, like their the color of their skin or what street they lived on or whatever, and what you've written about? Why is the womanist part there?
Yes, exactly. Thank you. So yeah, so the reason why that is there, so I guess let me start with the womanist theology, right? Because the womanist bioethics is grounded in womanist theology and even Black liberation theology, right? And Black bioethics, right? Because there are bioethicists who are of African descent who for years had been saying, even in the inception of the field of bioethics, they had been saying to their white colleagues, hey, look,
what the hell we really
need to, you know, they're like, we need to pay attention to the experiences and the perspectives and the voices of minoritized folk in this country. You know, African-American folks, they've had a different experience in this nation because of their race, and there are other groups who've had a different experience because of ethnicity. And we need to be talking about that, because what has happened is we have health disparities, right, in the U.S. And the health disparities are grounded, they're rooted in the kind of historical racial discrimination, you know, that we're talking about here. Because health disparities are these preventable differences in health outcomes among groups, right, measured by this occurrence and predominance of disease and adverse health conditions. So womanist bioethics is grounded in, you know, these theologies, like womanist theology, and that's a response to mainstream theology, right? Which is very much grounded in European American experience, and mainstream theology, you know, left out voices and experience of these marginalized groups. So that's why we have feminist theology, Black liberation theology, because with that, what was left out is the experience of African Americans who were marginalized, not just because of race, but also economically as well, right? So that's why womanist bioethics is so important, is because it's actually expanding. It's expanding the narrative of bioethics, more so than what feminist bioethics has done, because with feminism, that is focused primarily on, you know, middle class, you know, white women's experience. And that was a big criticism of feminism and the feminist movement by Black women and other women of color. They were saying, wait a minute, you're leaving out a whole swath of experiences and perspectives that are really important. And so that's how womanism came about, right? And in response to that. And so that's what is central to womanist bioethics is with this, I'm trying to expand the narrative, expand the conversation so that we can include these minoritized voices and experience is when we talk about, you know, healthcare, when we talk about technology, science, and the environment, because I don't think that we can really deal with health, science, technology. We can't deal with medicine. We can't deal with these things without them being in this broader context of the environment, right? Our relationship to creation, to nature, right? To our food source, you know? And so I think that is what's really significant about Womanist Bioethics is expanding the narrative, right? Broadening the conversation.
So this may not even be a coherent question, so I don't know, but could you give an example, mm-hmm. or is that of how a traditional perspective of bioethics would address a question of science or health or whatever, and how a womanist bioethical perspective yeah. would address it so that you can tease out what's the difference there?
Yeah. So actually we can look at just women. So women in general have been, if we look at when you have studies, when we have scientific studies done to look at drug efficacy and whatnot, right? A lot of times when you're testing a drug, what would happen is you get a population of patients that you test the drug on, and usually their women were left out of that population, right? So historically, we have women being an understudied population, and definitely Black women, other women of color have been understudied populations within the field of science, you know, biomedical sciences and the field of healthcare. So that's one really big, I think, example that we look at. We need to...
And wait, can I just end? Mm-hmm. So a drug is studied. The subjects that go through the study are not, as a rule, this is an example, women or women of color or both. And yet the drug is something that gets used by women and women of color, et cetera, et cetera. And have there been instances, and I'm not trying to nail you down here, but have there been instances when because of that, the drug is actually either not effective on women of color or actually dangerous or right, because they haven't been part of the sample?
So here's what's really I think it's I'm probably not going to get the name of the drug right, but there was a drug that was used by African American population. There was adverse response to it. And so what folks are saying is they're saying, wait a minute, if we're going to, you know, study drugs, if we're going to look at, you know, the efficacy of what we're doing in healthcare, we really have to include all people or as many people as we can, right? We have to have diversity. And that's what's really important.
It's a weird mistake to make, right? You know, because it's basic science, right? Like if you really want to, and so there's a way in which, well, what they would be, you could imagine the response, hey, why didn't you test this on Black women or women?
Women,
it's like,
yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, we're all the same. Men and women are all the same. Oh, really? If that's true, how come they can't go into this hospital? Like, it's a very peculiar.
It's wild.
You have to stand in a really weird position to not think of that as, that's just full on racism.
And you know what,
sexism or whatever it is.
Well, I'll say also what's very interesting. So I know when people, and so there are kind of arguments around like at the genetic level, right? Because we're very, it's very clear if you look at all of us from you know, level of genetics. Yes, we are so similar.
Absolutely.
We're more alike than
exactly.
Right. So you know, so there are kind of arguments around this notion of race, and taking it into consideration, race and biology and genetics and all of that. So, right. So yes, that is a morass there.
Yeah.
But what's really important though, is that within healthcare, it's interesting, and in public health. So the field of public health has really started doing a great job of addressing this notion of race. So there's this notion of racism as a root cause, right? And so the public health field is really looking at racism as a social determinant of health, right? And so they are, I think they are definitely ahead of the game, more so than bioethics, because in the field of bioethics, we are still kind of squabbling over, you know, this notion of race and its significance and racism within the field. The field has not, and this is what I talk about in the book, particularly in the beginning of the book, is I do say, look, I'm joining a conversation. You know, in this text, we're joining a larger conversation that has been going on for some years now, because we've had Black bioethicists who were trying to really get this conversation going in the field, but to, you know, making little headway because of the pushback, right? Because of the field not really acknowledging the significance of it. And so it's really, really, really important, I think, for us to definitely keep this conversation going, to try to open up this conversation and have this conversation in the field, because it is hard to have a conversation around the issue of race and racism and whatnot, particularly in this country, given that it is hard for a lot of times for people to accept the ugliness of our history when it comes to these issues. But because lives are at stake, because we have health disparities, right? We cannot ignore it. It's too important of an issue to ignore. And that's the significance of womanist bioethics.
We're really trying to
deal with it and say, okay, so we know this is happening. We know this is real. So now how do we address this so that we can help folks to live and thrive and flourish, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's two questions floating around at the same time. So I'm trying to keep them sorted. But, you know, one is, okay, so biologically, genetically, we are that, you know, the difference between people, you know, of different quote races is right. It's not there like that. It doesn't make any sense there.
Negligible. It's really small.
And yet there is clearly a difference. And so there's clearly a difference in racial outcomes medically, right? So that means that the lived experience of people in their communities may not have genetic effects, but they certainly have biological effects, right? And it feels like a gigantic omission to leave those differences out of the conversation, right? So,
yeah.
And the other question that's floating around has to do with, and maybe you've said it and I just didn't get it, but you know, your work started by, you know, but with both feet in theology. And what does that have to do with bio? Like, what What does church or whatever counts as a spiritual center have to do with this bioethical conversation, especially this womanist bioethical conversation?
Yes. And that is, oh my goodness, it's such an important question because of segregation and racial discrimination in the beginnings of American history, right? One of the things that happened is as Blacks were locked out of, you know, educational institutions, medical institutions and whatnot, what happened is, where could Black folks go? They went to those churches, right? They went to those faith communities. So the Black church has been, I mean, really significant and has a long history in this kind of public health activism in this nation. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Because African Americans have suffered, right, from these health disparities, you know, since the beginnings the establishment of the nation. The Black church has been that one institution that was fully controlled by Black people, right? And Black folks knew that they could go to these faith communities and not be turned away. Mm-hmm. So some Black churches some of them had clinics there at the church, right? But then others of them helped to start clinics that would serve Black folk and poor white folk. And so that whole role of these Black churches is really, really important historically. And that's why, you know, you have that kind of combination of faith and health.
Do the churches or I don't know what to call them, but, you know, centers of spirituality and faith and do they still play a role in that? I mean, do they still have a really?
Yeah. So when I was working at the Bioethics Center in the heart of the Alabama Black Belt, right? What we were doing was, that was at the time where we were, you know, the Affordable Care Act was, you know, kind of coming into play.
Yeah.
And we were working with faith communities because what happened was we were trying to help them help their constituents, right? To help folks get access to healthcare, to help folks understand what changes were coming down the pike when it came to healthcare access and whatnot. Because these were, you know, these are areas where they're really prominent, really high populations of poverty, economic stagnation. And so health disparities were really rampant. And so the places that those faith communities there were absolutely really active in addressing the issue of, you know, inadequate access to healthcare and health disparities. So the public and the field of public health has actually been working with, see, they're ahead of the game. They've been working with Black churches for years now, right? For decades on this issue of access, right? Public health access to care. And so bioethics, we are, I think we have, and I say this in the book, we have a lot to learn from fields like public health who've been engaging these Black churches, these faith communities, because these communities, they have a legacy. They really do. And a particularly Black church has a legacy of care, a long legacy of care. And some of the churches now, they still have a lot of them have health and wellness ministries, right? And so that was another thing in my job that I was trying to help churches. And churches would be calling me saying, hey, can you help us establish our health and wellness ministry? Because the needs are there. They're seeing it. They're seeing the disproportionate amount of African Americans in their communities suffering from, you know, cardiometabolic kind of risk factors. You know, even if you just look at some of the statistics, half of Black women 20 years and older have hypertension. Heart disease is a leading cause of death. for these women, and they're more likely than white women to be diagnosed with, you know, diabetes. So you know, these churches, they're seeing this. You know, the folks are coming in Sunday mornings or not coming in because they're on the sick and shut-in list, right? Because of chronic disease and whatnot. And so so these faith communities are sometimes, you can look at them as kind of like the first responders, so to speak, you know, especially for populations of people who don't have access to health care, or, you know, they're underserved, you know, in the health system. So, yeah, so these faith communities really do have a big part to play even today, right? Even today.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's studies, and there are even some studies, the literature, the scholarly literature, shows that, that race is, unfortunately, is still a factor in health and in health care. And so, you know, you look at it and you're like, man, we're in the 21st century, and yet we're still right here in this nation with respect to race and health. What is going on?
I'm chuckling because I was just about to ask the question, but not really the question. So I imagine that you're getting a lot of phone calls from the current administration in Washington for your help. You're probably not high on their list. I mean, I guess it's probably better to not be on the list at all, but yeah.
You know, it's interesting. So, yes, because what is really interesting, the phone calls are more from the faith communities, because faith communities in our history, we've been here before, right? We've been in a spot where we unfortunately don't have the support that we should be having from the administration, from the government. And so churches realize they really need to lean in into that legacy of care. They are really realizing that, hey, we got to lean in here, because we still have, you know, a disproportionate amount of populations that are suffering health disparities across the board for minoritized population and poor whites. So this is not, and that's what's important about my book. This issue of, you know, Black women's health, right? It is not just a Black woman's issue. It's not just a Black church issue. It is an issue for our nation, because one of the things that's really important about, you know, womanism, womanist theology, is that the starting point is Black women, right? We start with that experience to understand, you know, that experience, to understand the significance of including different perspectives and experiences. That's just a starting point. But the goal is for the flourishing, the thriving, the care, the love of all folk, not just minoritized communities, all of us, because we're all connected. We all have a hand in the health and in the flourishing of one another, right? And so that's what's important and that's why womanism is so important, right? It's because it has a kind of very particular starting point, but that's not where it ends, right? The goal, the aim is for humanity, is for the wholeness, the health, the care, the transformation of humanity.
Yeah. You know, it's so, obviously you've thought about this, but it's so, when you use the terms like womanism or racism, or there's that knee-jerk reaction to it, as if, well, wait a second, you know, it's like when it was Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
What was the first thing out of folks' mouths? Wait, all lives matter. What do you mean? What, you know, And it's a shame that there's that we have to go through that, because of course that makes perfect sense. I mean, right? I mean, it's the perspective of a mother. Womanism is a perspective of, look, we want all our kids to thrive. We want well-being for our whole family.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah.
Yeah, for the whole community, the whole nation, right?
Exactly.
I'm
sure you're right near the top of the call list for the administration. I'm sure it'll be any day now.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah, it's a little funny.
But it's so interesting because of kind of where we are now in this historical moment. I've really been leaning in to our ancestors, right? Because they have been where we are. They really have been here before. And I've been looking at kind of the significance of a lot of the work of folks who've gone before us was really rooted in this kind of centrality of faith, right? Centrality of this spirituality that taught that our moral teachings have to be accompanied by moral practice, right? By action that leads to healing, to restoration, to repair, right? And that's really what carried things like the civil rights movement. It really carried it. And this kind of faith, this kind of spirituality, it basically equips us with practices that form a life-giving mindset, because I think we've been bombarded with a kind of mindset in this historical moment, unfortunately, that has, I think, been death-dealing, right?
Yeah.
And so we really, I think we really have to center practices like, I've been doing a lot of lamenting. I really have been doing a lot of lamenting, and that is a very important Christian practice. It's kind of one of those ancient Christian practices, because nowadays people love to be happy and we don't want to deal with, you know, pain and sorrow and death and all of that. Yeah. But you know, lament is really a powerful practice that I think it's been really life-giving for me to go back to, right? It generates what I think is a very responsible faith and responsible spirituality, one that acknowledges, it not denies, but acknowledges our suffering and our pain.
Totally.
And it allows us to enter into one another's suffering and pain. And even if you can't enter into it, to accompany the other in it, right?
Absolutely.
To have that empathy, right?
Right.
That's what we all need.
Yeah.
And so,
grief is universal. And
yes. And
it's a place where, you know, it's one of those things that we all have in common.
All everybody, of us.
Right? Everybody. I mean, it's just a big story around here of this unfortunate situation where this woman, well, still unclear how, why, but this woman suffering from depression, postpartum, sadness, killed herself and her four children. And, you know, I mean, it's just devastating.
Yeah.
And, you know, and a resistance to, and a resistance to providing mental health counseling in a much bigger way.
Yeah.
And that's like, us like, I mean, it's almost like reminding everybody that grief and depression and sadness can, you know, it doesn't know. It doesn't know.
That's right.
It doesn't know where it's supposed to stay. It goes everywhere.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
You look at the numbers of rich people who've killed themselves over the years. And,
yeah,
you know, you live in that big house and with all those toys, and yet you are. So I think you're right. I think it's a way in. I always wonder about the secular bioethicists, right? I mean, they may not, they're not necessarily rooted in a particular faith, God of one sort or another, but they are, they certainly have a voice in that as well and say the same sorts of things. So, well, I'm looking at the time and I'm wanting to make sure we respect it. So is there something that if we stopped right now, you would 10 minutes from now go, oh man, I didn't say whatever. Is there something that feels important to say that we haven't said?
I would say one of the things that I think is important to say is kind of the what can we do? People will ask me a lot of times, what can we do? You know, the what can we do question, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, one of the things that I think we can do is like what you're doing, and I'm grateful for you helping to build awareness, right? Awareness, education, advocacy, and collaboration. Those are the four things that I really do focus on. And so if we can kind of continue that with this notion of awareness, making sure that we educate ourselves on various experiences of folks around us. Cause I mean, we are so, so connected. The great false narrative is how different we are from one another,
yeah.
How disconnected we are from one another, right. How isolated. No. The true narrative, the capital T true narrative is how we are so very connected and our fate is literally intertwined with one another, right? And we are so loved like that. Oh my gosh. If we can't get anything else, I pray. And even I'm trying to still get this, how loved we are, right? That is a powerful thing to try to grasp. It's just how much we are so loved. And so that for me is the one thing that I pray that we lean into with one another in this nation as we try to work toward healing and repair and restoration, is truly leaning into that love and connection with one another. Oh, I pray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I know that phone call is right. It's coming. So, well, Wyland Wilson, what a pleasure it is once again to speak with you. I really have enjoyed both of our conversations. I feel like I've known you for years.
So, thank you so much. It has been such a joy to just to be able to talk with you. I appreciate you tremendously.
You as well.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.